Before we begin this podcast, I'd like to tell you about a special deal. Subscribe today to The Spectator for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with, here's the magic bit, a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, Paul Wood looks at what Trump's victory in this week's US election could mean for the Middle East. From a South Korean island, Sean Thomas gets a glimpse into a childless future. Imogen Yates explores the trend within Gen Z of ecstatic dance. In the second part of our Books of the Year, some of our regular reviewers discuss their favourite books of 2024. You can hear from Peter Parker, Daniel Swift, Andrea Wolf, Claire Loudon, and Sarah Wheeler. And finally, the voice of the speaking clock himself, Alan Steadman, provides his notes on this emblem of accuracy. Up first, Paul Wood.
One of Donald Trump's 2024 campaign ads was aimed at Jewish voters. Three stereotypical New York bubbers are kvetching about the state of the world. Israel's under attack. Anti-Semitism like I never thought I would see. One says, oy vey, you know Trump I never cared for, but at least he will keep us safe. This was a canny appeal, recognising that many American Jews were traditionally Democrats and would have to hold their noses to vote for Trump. But Trump has been, as he says himself, Israel's protector. And Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was the first foreign leader to praise him for his victory. Congratulations on history's greatest comeback. Netanyahu signed off his message to Trump, quote, in true friendship, close quote. In truth, the two have a difficult history. They didn't speak for almost 4 years after Netanyahu recognised Joe Biden's win in 2020. In April, Trump made a number of digs at Bibi to Time magazine. He blamed him for the 7th of October massacre and said the Israeli leader had backed out of what was supposed to be a joint operation to assassinate the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. Trump said, that was something I never forgot. So not a stand-up guy, not loyal, the worst thing you can be in Trump world. They patched things up over the summer when Bibi visited Mar-a-Lago, all smiles and hugs by the pool. Trump later told one of his rallies that Netanyahu was calling him almost daily for advice. He said Israel should finish the problem in the war against Hamas. He revelled in the pager attacks on Hezbollah. All this is a reminder of how Trump was the American president who recognised Jerusalem as Israel's capital, who moved the US embassy there, and who ended the Iran nuclear deal. But Trump is also famously transactional, and America's military support for Israel reportedly cost $23 billion in the past year. He's also instinctively an isolationist and might this time bring enough loyalists into government to face down America's interventionist foreign policy establishment. Above all, he is a deal maker, and this is where the danger to Netanyahu lies. One of the greatest and most unexpected diplomatic triumphs of Trump's presidency was the Abraham Accords. Trump had told his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to go and make peace in the Middle East. To everyone's surprise, Kushner came back with a deal for the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain to recognise Israel. It might have helped that Kushner was being tutored by Henry Kissinger. The next logical step is for Saudi Arabia, too, to formally make peace with Israel. They were edging towards an agreement before the 7th of October. Now, though, the Saudi price for a deal is the creation of a Palestinian state, something Netanyahu has spent his entire career trying to stop. Kushner and his wife, Ivanka Trump, have said they won't return to the White House, too busy becoming billionaires as Kushner's investment fund is showered with cash. But while Kushner had no formal role in his father-in-law's election campaign, he was reportedly active behind the scenes. Could Trump call on him to work informally again, as a back channel to the Saudi leader. That informal role might suit Kushner. When Trump left office, Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, gave $2 billion to Kushner's fund. Staying out of office makes it much easier to accept these payments. Kushner and MBS always had a warm rapport, but getting MBS to drop the demand for a Palestinian state will be hard. In September, the Crown Prince appeared to strengthen his position, saying a Palestinian state is a condition of any peace agreement. This is necessary rhetoric for an authoritarian Sunni ruler keeping an eye on the Arab street, which has been inflamed by images of children's corpses in Gaza and Lebanon. But the Saudi royal family are ruthless in pursuit of their own interests, and Kushner, or some other envoy, will have the strongest possible card to play, the promise of a new defence pact with the US. Such an agreement is probably only possible as part of a deal for normalisation of Saudi-Israeli relations. Otherwise, even a Republican Senate would find it difficult to ratify yet another US military commitment. The Saudis might be persuaded to agree to some halfway house, a roadmap to a sovereign Palestinian state rather than its actual establishment. This is because the Middle East is on the brink of a catastrophic war that could ignite the whole region. The path to a wider war is clear. Israel and Iran are locked into an escalatory cycle. A month ago, Iran fired 180 ballistic missiles at Israel. Israel responded with precise and effective strikes on military installations, almost completely destroying Iranian air defences. The response to the response has yet to come, but senior Iranian officials have been quoted as saying it will be harsh and unimaginable. This is standard rhetoric, but Iran's supreme leader Ali Khamenei may feel he has to order something credible in order to avoid admitting defeat. Israel could then expand the war to hit oil facilities and Iran's nuclear program. The wider Middle East war might be raging by the time Trump takes office. Trump might feel the US should come into the war on Israel's side, if this isn't already happening by the time he swears the oath. It was unwise of Iran, if true as claimed, to run a covert influence operation to hurt Trump in the election. But Trump would also love to get out of the region altogether. He once said, "The single worst decision our country ever made was to go into the Middle East." Trump is mercurial, and it's hard to tell what he'll do next. The next 4 years are going to be a wild ride for leaders in the Middle East and everywhere else. But if there's a consistent theme, it is that he's no warmonger. He's spoken of his wish to end the multiple conflicts in the Middle East once and for all, and not, as he said, to have to come back to the region every 5 or 10 years. That would be the deal of the century. If it means a Palestinian state, Netanyahu will discover the truth of Palmerston's saying that nations have no eternal allies, only interests.
That was Paul Wood. Next, Sean Thomas.
If you're looking for a pointer for the future of the world, the free-diving fisherwomen on the matriarchal, shamanistic South Korean island of Jeju are not an obvious example of where we're heading. Because the Hainyo are famously unique and famously hardy. But what is happening to them should concern us all. In simple wetsuits, they spend hours in the cold, clear waters seeking out sea slugs, oysters, conches and abalone. They are fiercely independent. They spearheaded resistance to the Japanese in the 1930s and 40s. But here's the thing. As Nari, age 70, tells me in the Hainyo's coastal mudroom, "We are probably the last. We have been diving since the men went to war in the 18th century, but maybe no one will do this in 20 years' time." The stats bear out her pessimism. In the 1960s, there were around 20,000 Hainyo. Now there are just 2,000 or so. The vast majority are over 50. Only 20-odd girls began Hainyo training last year. And the decline isn't just because this diving is hard, although it is also lucrative. It is because Jeju, like the rest of Korea, indeed the rest of Asia, and pretty soon most of the world, is swiftly aging and will soon start depopulating. The median age of Jeju, population 600,000, is 58. For contrast, in Britain it is 40, in the USA 39, and in wider Korea 45. This is partly because Jeju, with its fine beaches and clean air, attracts retirees, but also because no one is having children. In Jeju, the total fertility rate is around 0.9, less than one child per woman, when the replacement rate is 2.1. The result, especially out of high season when youthful tourists are gone, is a noticeably and painfully aged society. Schools are merging or closing entirely. Outside central Jeju City, the lack of children in playgrounds and schoolyards and on the streets is stark. As I walk around, struck by the silence and by the octogenarian tangerine sellers and parking attendants, South Korea has a policy of getting the old back into work, I realise I have witnessed this lack of children's laughter once before, during the lockdowns, when all the schools by my London flat were shut, and the joyous babble of kids, the giggles, whoops and shouts so constant I never really noticed their presence before, suddenly became a piercing absence, like someone had removed all the birds from an ancient wood, along with their endless ambient song. Again, we could console ourselves that weird South Korea is an outlier. South Korea is, after all, the hermit kingdom. Before it finally opened up in the 19th century, it was probably the most isolated large country on earth. North Korea continues this tradition. However, as we know, South Korea might be culturally quirky, but in plunging birth rates, it is far from special. It is, arguably, just leading the pack. Last week, it was announced that England and Wales have their lowest birth rate in written history, 1.44 births per woman. The same is happening in the USA, where births are at a record low, and also in Europe, Asia and the Americas. Such is the collapse that significant countries are starting to depopulate: Italy, Cuba, Portugal, China, Romania, Japan. Many of these have long suffered from emigration. The difference is that in the past, natural live births easily replaced the emigres. Not anymore. Why is this happening? 100 plausible explanations have been advanced, from microplastics to female emancipation, from the death of religion to hormones in the water supply, from online porn to the distraction of smartphones. Regarding the latter, in Seoul, they have traffic lights set in the ground by intersections so that people staring down at their phones can at the same time see "don't walk" red lights and won't step into traffic. In truth, the answer must be a complex cocktail with perhaps some ingredients we don't yet recognise. All we can do is examine the flavour. And on this trip, I am also visiting Japan, median age 49, birth rate 1.37, and it's there that I get a striking early taste of our childless future. It happens in the lovely little sake brewing town of Hida Furukawa in Gifu Prefecture, central Japan. The population has declined by half in 50 years and now teeters on the edge of feasibility, as the surviving population of 20,000 is so old. I have never been to a sizeable town which is so eerily and unnervingly quiet, car-free and people-less. At night, as I walk between the temples and the ginkgos along the lamplit canals filled with golden carp, I do not see a soul. I am utterly alone with the fireflies. It's like strolling through a melancholic haiku. The next day, I wake up to bright sunshine burning the mist off the forested Japanese Alps, and I see a rare and magnificent pair of mountain hawk eagles in the middle of town, soaring above the bridge. If Hida Furukawa was busy and noisy, they would surely not come here. But now, as it falls silent, nature returns. As I walk to one of the town's last izakayas for a cup of warm sake, I am reminded of the words of the poet of Gerard Manley Hopkins. Let them be left, let them be left. Long live the weeds and the wilderness yet.
That was Sean Thomas, now Imogen Yates.
2 months ago, I moved to London and found it a disorientating experience. Most of my friends were already settled when I got here, and I found myself overwhelmed, isolated, and always on the wrong Circle Line train. Everyone seemed to have their thing, something they belonged to. What was mine? I tried a 5 a.m. run club. It was horrendous. I tried the East London conceptual art scene but couldn't keep a straight face. Then, one Friday night, I found myself in church, but not for a prayer service. This church was deconsecrated, converted, and the activity that evening was something called ecstatic dance. Yet the setting was appropriate because, as I discovered, for wellness-obsessed millennials and Gen Zers, ecstatic dance is a sort of religion. It's a place where my generation can feel they belong, and where the quest for transcendence is alive and grooving. Ecstatic dance is a DJ-led sober dance party. According to Urubu Collective, who organised my dance, it supports your free expression of emotions and inner space through movement and music, and allows you to unleash your wild dancing self without caring what people think, claim your freedom and touch the infinite. The rules are simple. No shoes, no drugs, and most definitely, no deodorant. When I entered the heated room to meet my fellow dancers, I knew immediately that I had understood the dress code wrong. Among the palazzo pants and the 100% hemp, my all-black athleisure set wasn't doing the trick. I was relieved that I at least forgot to shave my armpits. Our facilitator for the evening, a female DJ, stepped up to the deck, where a woman in a flower crown started playing something called handpan techno. Let your inner space guide your dance. Move however it wants you to, she called out to the crowd. A woman draped in white cloth slunk around the room. Someone's dad was already going for it, closing his eyes and waving his arms around. Soon, the room was pulsing with swaying and quivering bodies. At first, I felt incredibly awkward. We newcomers were told we must make and maintain eye contact with other dancers as we moved around. It was as if the normal social codes had been reversed. Then, the MC instructed us to become different animals and to move as if we were our chosen animal. I was deeply impressed by the number of people who really committed to this. Perhaps our animal might say hello to another that crosses its path, the handpan woman suggested. I chose a monkey. A terrible decision, as I found myself ooh-ooh-ah-ah-ing in a standoff with a middle-aged woman turned silverback gorilla. Someone chose a fish, which involved a lot of floor work. I'd never seen a bear and a peacock interact before, and it ends how you imagine. The males, alpha wolves or big cats, preyed on the females, deer and antelope. I inadvertently made eye contact with a sweaty bald man on the other side of the room. I'm reasonably used to sweaty bald men approaching me in clubs, and my usual reaction is to flee, or at least to cover my drink. Thankfully, this one convulsed away when I didn't return his bird squawk. We continued our dance, this time to thumpier music than the handpans. It was getting sweaty. On my right, two bodies were caressing each other, and they ended up in a heap in the corner. Their animals definitely said hello. After nearly an hour, I started to ease out of my rigidity. I actually did feel an unthinking freedom. It seemed like for as long as the dance was going on, anything went. I moved without purpose and bumped into bodies. After the dancing, we gathered in a circle for a ceremony. We passed around a drink made with cacao powder, and I sipped the bitter liquid while a soft hum rose and swelled. We chanted, "We gather here together, our hearts connected as one. Cacao Sita Medicina guide us." And before I knew it, I was added to a WhatsApp group intended for people to make new friends in London. Urubu Collective offers a whole host of other events, including bioenergetics, shaking medicine, and system reset classes. The Cuddle community caught my eye, a touch positive, non-sexual soothing group offering bi-weekly meetings in Islington. The criteria for attending include craving community connection. I didn't feel exactly ecstatic in the ecstatic dance community, but I have to admit I was tempted to accept the invitation to the full moon ritual that popped up later on my group chat. I was looking for a community in London that existed outside of the pub. Could this be it? Or perhaps I should just go back to my parents for the weekend.
That was Imogen Yates. And now the second part of our books of the year from some of our regular reviewers, Peter Parker, Daniel Swift, Andrea Wolfe, Claire Loudon, and Sarah Wheeler.
The New Zealand novelist Catherine Chidgey ought to be much more celebrated in this country than she is. Do not be put off by the fact that the Axeman's Carnival, Europa, £14.99, is narrated by a magpie. Whimsy is entirely absent from this highly original, thrillingly dark, and often very funny novel. The bird is adopted by the wife of a cash-strapped farmer and learns to speak, becoming an internet sensation and so providing useful income. At the same time, its guileless chatter includes picked-up phrases that inadvertently expose what is really going on in the household where it has made its home. Treat of the year was Sheila Robinson, Balance, Humanity and Nature, Random Spectacular, £27.50, a clumsily titled but beautifully produced and lavishly illustrated account of the life and work of this wonderful printmaker and illustrator, whose career has sometimes been overshadowed by the other male artists associated with Great Bardfield.
Caroline Lucas was the UK's first Green Party MP and also did a PhD in English literature. Her Another England, How to Reclaim Our National Story, deftly marries the political and the literary, ranging over the myths and visions of England and Englishness offered by poets, novelists and politicians, including Edward Thomas, P.D. James, William Blake, Stanley Baldwin and Boris Johnson. She argues that our literary history gives us rich material from which to build a new sense of this country, our place in it, and how we might face the future. Another England is idealistic, naive and freewheeling, as urgent and lively books often are. I loved it, and it is certainly my book of the year.
Normally I find it difficult to choose the best book of the year, but not so this time. My absolute favourite is Richard Powers' Playground. He's one of our finest storytellers, taking important present-day subjects, from environmental issues to AI, and turning them into riveting novels. What his Overstory did for trees, Playground is doing for the oceans. Powers weaves together science, emotions and our wonder at nature. The result is a mesmerising, hugely important tale. I also enjoyed a very different kind of book, non-fiction, quieter, slower, but also fascinating. Martin Goodman's My Head for a Tree is about the Bishnoi, a community in India who protect trees with their lives, and they're the first true environmentalists, and their story is remarkable. Throughout the year, I've immersed myself in Maggie O'Farrell's back catalogue, and the more I read, the more I admire her genius to create worlds into which I can disappear. There's a joy in acquainting oneself with the writer's oeuvre, a pleasure which I haven't really allowed myself since my early 20s. Too many books, too many writers, too many stories, too many distractions. I'm refusing to pick one of her titles because the delight lies in their entirety.
My inner medieval history geek was roused from dormancy by Bart Van Loo's gloriously rambunctious The Burgundians, A Vanished Empire, published by Apollo and priced at £12. It tells the tale of the Burgundian dukes who presided over Flanders during its extraordinary late medieval boom time. Van Loo whisks the reader through bloody battles, scurrilous infighting and plenty of political intrigue, accompanied by memorable character portraits of murderous John the Fearless, randy Philip the Good and creepy Charles the Bold. As in so many early Netherlandish paintings, however, the star of the show is the background detail, from descriptions of eye-poppingly lavish Burgundian feasts to discussions of technology, textiles and the medieval relationship with time.
Like all Ian Frazier's books, Paradise Bronx, Farrar, Straus and Giroux, £26.60, shows that seeing is more important than travelling. Frazier paints a portrait of a New York borough crouching in the shadow of Manhattan, one the size of Paris, with 42 branches of McDonald's and a single bookshop. He brilliantly pulls off the hardest thing, to blend history and personal narrative and not let the joins show. On another note, I enjoyed Tom Gunn by Michael Knott, Faber, £25. The book reveals slowly but rather wonderfully how a great writer makes the choices that shape him. Knott conveys, with tenderness, what happens when desire takes the upper hand.
That was our Books of the Year. And finally, Alan Steadman.
Ask young people today if they know that they can dial a number to hear the time, and you would probably be met with blank stares. Why would you pay to phone a speaking clock when the time is right there in front of you on your watch or phone screen? However, if you were young in bygone days, you may have memories of getting parental permission to phone Tim and hear somebody telling the time precisely. In fact, every year millions of people still phone the service, now the BT speaking clock, almost 90 years after its introduction. It was launched by the Post Office on the 24th of July 1936 and was aimed at folk who did not have a clock or watch to hand. Before that, you had to phone the exchange operator to settle any dispute as to what the correct time was, and of course mechanical timepieces were not always reliable. The speaking clock is a very accurate service indeed. To within 5 milliseconds, that's 5/1000th of a second. Even Big Ben takes its time from it. The service was originally accessed by dialing 846, which coincided with the letters TIM, giving it its colloquial name. However, this code was only used on the telephone systems for the major cities. Other numbers were 952, followed by 80 and 8081, until it was standardised as 123 in the early 1990s. Calls to the speaking clock increase on four very time-sensitive days, as midnight approaches on New Year's Eve, when the clocks change in March and October, and on Remembrance Sunday for the two-minute silence. Nowadays, other services are available, but the BT speaking clock remains an emblem of accuracy, and one that still uses a real voice. The first golden voice belonged to Ethel Jane Kane, an exchange operator for Croydon. Unfortunately, a slight speech impediment was detected at the end of some sentences, and apparently it took months to eradicate this from the glass discs onto which her voice was recorded. The other permanent voices have belonged to Pat Simmons, 1963 to 1985, Brian Cobby, 1985 to 2007, Sara Mendes da Costa, 2007 to 2016, and, well, me. I've had that privilege since the 9th of November 2016, after I entered and won a competition run by BT and the BBC for children in need. I have the first Scottish voice, and as is the trend these days, it is somewhat removed from the received pronunciation of previous ones. The recordings took place over two sessions at the BT Tower in London, and although the technology bore no resemblance to that in 1936, the script was remarkably similar. It was broken up into segments of hours, minutes and seconds, and the well-known phrases of "at the third stroke" and "precisely" were of course still there. 8 years on, I'm still asked for the time when out and about, and I'm sure there are those who think I tell the time live every day. I've been asked if I'm having a day off or if someone else is covering from me as I make my way round the supermarket. A personal favourite? This speaking clock job. What are the hours like? It's even been suggested that my epitaph should read, "At the third stroke."
And that's everything for this week. For more articles, pick up a copy of The Spectator magazine or check out our website. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd really appreciate a rate, review, and a follow. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.